cordially welcome you to Into My Podcast, My Music Leben. I have studied classical singing and voice, and I love to sing contemporary music. And if you would like to know more about me and my concerts and performances and opera premieres, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I put this also into the show notes for you. You could also subscribe to my monthly newsletter. In this podcast, I talk about themes all around contemporary music. I share with you behind the scenes insider knowledge, and I love to bring you the human beings out of this music world closer. I'm cooperating with NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, one of the most important German-speaking music papers. And this is a very, very special episode. It's my 8th anniversary, or the 8th anniversary of this podcast, Neue Musik Leben. I started it on the 10th of April in 2018. I feel so proud, and yeah, this is so great that I'm still here, that I'm still talking to you, that you're listening to me. You're listening to me from everywhere on this whole globus. Which is so exciting to me. And I also thank you so much for all the emails you write me, for the encounters, because sometimes I'm performing somewhere and people come up to me and like, oh, I'm listening to your podcast. And so thank you for showing your face to me, who you are. And that is so, so amazing. And I have a very special, amazing guest for you today in this anniversary podcast. It's the soprano Lucy Shelton, and she is 82 years old in April, and she also performs Innocence by Kaya Sarayahu at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And I found this so interesting that I really wanted to talk to her, and we have some common friends, so I got in touch with her, and I have this great interview with her for you. And she is an amazing singer, a warm-hearted person, and smart. And she also shares many insights with you. And for me, she's also a role model in that way to show what is possible. And I often talk about those things that sometimes people tell themselves, no, this is not possible, this cannot work. And in the end, that is just a story. It's something your mind is telling you. And to see that someone with this age, and maybe some people would think, well, this is not possible. Yes, she's still singing, she's healthy, and she's doing the debut at the Met. And I think this opens up so many possibilities for all of us. I'm so inspired by a woman like Lucy Shelton. So let's dive into the interview with Lucy Shelton.
Hello, Lucy Shelton. I cordially welcome you into my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Thank you very much, Irene.
And I'm so excited to have such a wonderful singer here in this podcast. And we're going to get into great topics, I think. And I would like to know from you first, how did you find your way into this new and experimental music? Because you're singing lots of contemporary music, I have seen.
Yes. Well, I started very early just loving odd sounds. I'm one of five kids. My parents met at an amateur music singing thing. And we all took piano lessons. We all had other instruments. Mine was flute. And we did silly things like sing dissonances and get excited by it. We used to do Bach chorales by sliding between the pitches. So you'd get all the variations between the pitches, and you'd have to wait for whoever had the biggest interval to get there, and then the chord would come in to be clear and exciting, and then you'd mess it all up again as you move to the next. Anyway, I always loved improvising. My piano teacher gave me contemporary things to work on, and I went to a music camp on flute, and most of the chamber music for flute, well, yeah, it tends to be contemporary. I was never afraid of it, and I even have to say I loved it. And I was eager to do when I went to college. I didn't go to a conservatory, I went to liberal arts. I was eager to be the one to realize anything anybody wanted to write, both on flute and voice. And I have to say, I think one reason I'm still singing is that I have had so much variety in my singing career. I mean, if I'd been just doing opera, which is glorious, but you use your voice in kind of in the same way, in a healthy way, presumably, while you're in your career, and then there stop being roles for you, and you stop singing. But I've never stopped singing, and I'm quite sure that's because I've had so much. I mean, I still can sing at age 81 in a way that people still enjoy hearing. And I mean, I'm taking lessons now. I didn't for many, many years take any lessons, but it's helping me at this stage of my life to get a little advice.
Wow. I mean, you already touched so many important points. I mean, I assume you also had then classical voice training at some point. Yeah.
Yes, I certainly did. When I finished, I was a music major at Pomona College, and I did recitals both in flute and in voice. My voice recital would never have been approved in a conservatory because I did the Abendberg Sieben frühe Lieder, and I did Mozart Exultate Jubilate. I did Benjamin Britten on this island. I did Mio Catalogue of Flowers. I mean, I did things that I really wanted to do, and something by the composer at the Carl Cohn. And it was that recital which got me into, I didn't ever audition for a conservatory. In fact, this is an interesting aside. I've done maybe a total of three auditions in my life. That's just crazy because the chamber music field that I was in and new music, you do a good job. It's grassroots. People who, conductors or other players, will, if they liked working with you, will tend to say, "Oh, you're looking for a soprano? Ask Lucy." And that's the way it was when I first came to New York, and it just sort of built from that. I think I strayed from your original question, but what was your question? Let me just say also, because of doing both flute and voice, I literally had to think through, well, what do I want to pursue after college? And my reasoning was, well, flute, let's see. I mean, I've done all the Bach sonatas, I've done wind quintets, I don't really want to be in an orchestra. I kind of know the rep. I've done the piston sonata. But voice, oh my gosh, I will never run out of repertoire. And I love languages, and it just seemed it's such a direct communication with the voice. Yes, I think I'll be happy singing rather than fluting.
Yeah,
So
and
right from the start, it wasn't because I had a great voice, or I mean, I had a fine voice, but I really, it was the repertoire, the excitement for the music that made me want to pursue
yeah,
that.
the curiosity and but I also imagine, I mean, when you started out singing, those were different times than nowadays. And even when I started or I left college, I also was one of the awkward ones because she was singing contemporary music and I had the same experience that people would just, you know, they liked it and they would recommend me to other places. And I mean, even when I sang, I learned a lot on my own because I had no role models. And I assume for you there was even less. And nowadays, I mean, you're teaching contemporary music, and we now also have singers who teach contemporary music. But back then, there was so little.
Well, I actually, my teacher at Pomona was not a singer. She was a pianist. She played my recital. So right there, it was m music training rather than, I mean, she knew stuff about the voice, but I have to say I was very anti technique just for technique's sake. I kind of developed my technique because of the challenges that were given to me in the repertoire. And I heard how, I mean, I knew if it was not singing well. I mean, I knew how to sing well, but it was the challenges of the rep that made me really develop a technique, I think. But I did definitely have a role model in the wonderful mezzo Gian De Gaetani. And I didn't work with her until the 70s, 71 or something, and I graduated from the conservatory. Well, that wasn't that, 2 years after I graduated from conservatory, got my master's. And she had a career, a non-operatic career. She once told me that she'd been asked to do something at the Met, but they told her she'd have to dye her hair because she had premature gray. I mean, it seems kind of bizarre, but and she wasn't going to do that. I have no idea what the rep was, but I did Dido and Aeneas with her. I mean, I did a few little projects with her, both at Aspen Festival and I don't know if it was in Cleveland or some other place, which is. But she had a career that was old music. Well, it was basically the rep that I do now. Song, recital repertoire. She used to say you should always have three recitals ready to go. Well, I haven't kept that up. And unfortunately, I think very few American singers pay attention to the absolutely fabulous repertoire there is for recitals. And she was doing a lot of premieres. And in being with her and going to her concerts, I met these composers like George Crumb and Rochberg and Milton Babbitt, the American big honcho guys of the late 20th century. And well, she actually recommended somebody for my commissioning things from the Naumburg prize. And her existence in music, I mean, she was so clearly satisfied by it, and she just presented, she was so communicative, and her cheeks would flush when she sang. It was so exciting, kind of. I mean, she looked the most beautiful when she was doing her art. And it was such a beautiful community. So I knew it had happened with her, and it was something that I saw for myself. So very much a role model.
Awesome. Yeah, she's a great singer. Yeah, I also know many of her recordings, and I also liked already what you said, that maybe the singing contemporary music even makes your voice fresher, younger, more flexible. Because before I started out this podcast, I started writing a book, and it had the working title was "New Music Does Not Hurt My Voice," because often after performances, people would come up to me and were like saying, "Doesn't this hurt your voice?" And then I started thinking about it. And as the thing was, as more as I thought about it, as more I found proof that it's the opposite. And I also had a quite known new music singer in my podcast, Sara Maria Sun. And we also talked about this, and she has a doctor for the sinuses, and he looks in a lot of throats and at the chords. And he said to her, "You know what? I only found notes with opera singers, never with a singer who does contemporary music." Then we thought about the tune. She's like, "Okay, they're less from by us. We're a smaller group." But Sarah also said, "We're doing so many different things. You can never get like tied." And she thinks that's the valid thing. And I'm now, whatever, also aging. And people always tell me after performances, "You're getting better and better and better." And I feel the same. And I'm like, what is this? Maybe it is really the opposite. And now you're singing at the Metropolitan Opera, and you also say, no, I'm doing fine with my voice. And so what do you want to
Yeah.
add, or what is your
Well,
take on that?
I certainly don't have the range I used to have, but I agree with you totally that the variety, the challenges in doing new music and that we use our voices. I mean, the idea that, yes, we can sing non-vibrato. What's wrong with that? You know, that's totally healthy. You can make any, this is one of Jan's statements. You can make any sound in a unhealthy way or in a healthy way, you know, that, and her other thing was, there's no one beautiful sound. The beautiful sound is what is appropriate to the music. So I love that one too. So the fact that I'm singing at the Met Opera is, I'm not an opera singer, and an 82-year-old opera singer probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. My role is Sprechstimme primarily. I do have some purely beautiful sung tones, but it was written with me in mind, and we worked on it together, Kaya Sarriaho, and it's a very special kind of singing, which in fact opera singers, I mean, like, oh, I mean, they don't know how to do it. And I have had understudies in this role, and only one of them is asked to have a coaching with me. And I appreciated that and tried to guide her, but it's against their training to slide between pitches and to not have vibrato and to be expressive sort of from a speech pattern rather than from a, you know, pointy, resonant, single sound. So that's very interesting. I mean, I'm able to do it because it's a technique that I've done basically all my life, and it's a technique that I claim anybody could do, and we all use our voices that way when we're telling stories. If you talk to your, if you're reading da 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 da, you're telling a dramatic story to your, from, in my sake, I don't have grandchildren, but grandnieces, great nieces, little kids, you reading a story book for them. We all use voices that have a big range, way beyond our normal speaking range. So, and actually actors, well, there's a recording. I think his name was Moissy, of a famous actor doing Erlkönig. And there's 2.5 octave range in how he's reading that, delivering that story. There is Sprechstimme right there. It's in the actor's world, maybe more than the singer's world. But
I
it's
actually
a,
have a student who also is more like a regular opera singer at a nice house in Germany. And for some reason, he came to me. At first, I thought, what can I teach him? But he's now coming for 5 years already. And he knows that I'm doing contemporary music. And he's not at all. He's doing the classical repertory. But there were points when I explained things that it suddenly clicked, because I also said, if you can consciously control if you sing something airy or not airy, you're the master. And
yeah.
so I feel we are much more aware what everything is possible with this voice. And I had the same experience like you. I mean, I didn't have really role models or teachers for a long time for contemporary music. I mean, I had someone for my whatever classical singing or and so everything was like trial and error in a way, but I figured it out to find a way, as you said, that it's healthy and it never hurt me. And I even sometimes when I really sang very wild pieces where I thought, okay, this is now on the edge, then I always would sing like a Handel aria afterwards
Yeah,
to make
you're fine.
sure I'm fine. And the weird thing was the Handel aria got better and better.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, that's super.
It's so crazy, and it's I mean, I think you bring such a great spirit. I mean, you break all the limits, because I mean, with your age and with the music you're doing, and I'm like, this is just so amazing. And you
I
open the opportunities for all of us. What else is possible, you know?
well, I keep finding repertoire that, I mean, there's so much repertoire out there, and I have one piece that I've been doing is sort of my favorite feel-good piece. I've opened, I did a faculty recital recently up at Manhattan School that had Pierrot Lunaire on the second half. The first half was all moon-related things, well, except the first, which is my piece that I love to do, and it's by Sofia Gubaidulina, Unaccompanied Visions from Hildegard von Bingen. Do you know that piece? Well, that just sets me up. I love the fact that it has breathy tone. You start off with a breathy tone, and then you go into focus tone. It has these big leaps, very expressive leaps from low A, finally up to a G sharp above the staff. I mean, that's reverse leap from G sharp down low. Anyway, it just lines me up. It's a reflective text. I don't sing it particularly as a religious text. I mean, it is a religious text, but for me, it's just such a focus, reverent text, and it just, I don't know, it lines me up. And then I do a piece by Anna Sokolovich with viola, and that which is about the moon, looking at the moon, and then a piece by Shulamit Ron, which is called Moon Songs. Well, look at that. Isn't that nice with Pierrot Lunaire, which is about Pierrot
Awesome.
the moon? And it happened to be three women composers. I mean, I didn't even, very often people look, ah, oh, I want to do women. There they are, Gubaidulina, Sokolovich, and Ron. So that's how I've opened that program. And I just did a Pierrot with students in Kansas University. And I used those same three pieces to open that program. So,
Who was the teaching them? Are they open nowadays for this
oh, it
kind
was
of music?
so wonderful. This was just last week, so I'm still kind of high from it. Were they all graduate students? Or I think one was, the flutist was still an undergrad, maybe. They had prepared, so they prepared all last semester or fall semester, thinking they would have a performance in November. But I have to believe, I mean, they canceled it because the singer, I think, must have gotten absolutely no guidance, and she wasn't handling it, and she was relieved not to be doing it. And then they asked me, and I kind of surprised them by saying yes. But it's just perfect. I wish I could do that 3 times a year, because working with young students in with them rather than doing a master class, which seems, I don't love doing master classes. Well, usually it's all operatic repertoire, which, okay, I can maybe offer a little bit, but I'm not really. Anyway, this actually being in the middle of the ensemble, making music with them was just thrilling. And they played the softest movement number 4 that I've ever heard, because I said, make it really, really. And somehow they're not so far along that they have to hear their big sound all the time. There was something about, okay, she wants us to play triple P. We could do that. We can do that. And it was glorious. And a professional group doesn't dare, I don't know, they don't do the limits. It
It's
was
so
thrilling.
great to hear that the students are also opening up. I mean, I actually did my undergrad at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas.
No, okay.
And
Wow.
they also I think they still have it, they had a new music ensemble which also performed then at the Dallas Symphony, and there were also participants from the orchestra in it. And we also had then something called New Music Ensemble, which we're supposed to attend, I don't know, 1 or 2 semesters. And all the other singers, they signed up and they never showed up. I was the only one who showed up. I also had no clue, but somehow it draw me, and the teachers were amazing. I was so impressed. And then it ended up that I was singing all the contemporary music, and all the colleges in Texas, they all were like, oh, there's this crazy German girl, just ask her.
Well, that's the way it works. It's so fabulous because not everybody wants to do it. I mean, that's a no-brainer, you know, go to the, it's so exciting to be doing things that other people don't think they can do, you know, or have no interest. They're afraid of it, actually, or their teachers are afraid of it. And it's so silly.
Looking back, I'm so grateful. But then I also thought, like, why aren't they even showing up and give it a try? I mean, try it, and then you can still say, okay, this is not my cup of tea, but at least try.
I have a feeling teachers may be influencing in that way. That's maybe a bad mouthing the profession, but I feel like certainly in the States, the voice faculty, voice studios, they hardly do song repertoire. And okay, they might do a Britten aria or a John Adams aria, or I mean, something that's really gotten into the canon already. But I feel like they spend all their time working on auditions to make that impression to get a job. They are not developing their craft of communicating and sharing their music making. It's they do it to make an impression. Well, that is not a valid, I mean, okay, you do that for an agent or something, I guess. I mean, but it's not really sustainable for your heart, it seems to me. And it isn't really giving anything to the music. You're not giving the music to your listeners. You're just trying to show off. I don't like that.
But I think in the end, the audience feels it too. If you're there as the real person and giving it all,
they notice. Yeah.
And I also found it interesting that you said you're also, you know, working with a teacher again. And I know that singers are the only ones who take lessons. I take lessons. I have a teacher I go to, not often, but once in a while. And we are more like sports person. I feel like professional sports person. And I mean, all the whatever professional, whatever they play, soccer or baseball, they have coaches. And all those whatever pianists and instrumentalists, they hardly have anyone. They don't go anywhere, at least in my circle. And the singers always do, because I mean, we don't hear ourselves correctly. I mean, there are challenges. And I also found it interesting because I know it, and I think I can mention it. I was very fond how Edita Grubarova sang also in her later ages, Edita Grubarova. And there are some amazing recordings from her singing Lucia di Lammermoor with 70, just stunning. And I think from the Bavarian Staatsoper or something like that. And I found then out through another singer who I was exchanging with, and he also helped me with a few things. And he works with the same teacher that Edita went when she was 60 years old. And she also was smart enough, even though she was a world-known singer. And she's like, if I want to continue, I think I should work on it. And she went regularly for lessons, and she got better and better and better.
Well, I was ready to give up. I did my 75th birthday recital, and that sort of felt like closure. I had 14 colleagues come. I mean, like five different pianists and instrumentalists and other singers, students of mine, joined me. It was a beautiful occasion, but it wasn't, turned out not to be the end. But I wasn't taking lessons. I didn't take lessons until after that, I think. And of course, I'm studying with somebody that I used to teach, or not. I mean, he was at Tanglewood. I 20 years doing new music at Tanglewood. But I really was ready to shut the door on it. But no, I guess no. I can't remember what turned me around, but well, one very nice comment from a colleague saying, when I was worried about my current, at that time, vocal abilities, and he said something like, "Lucy, we love listening to you for the m music that you bring. I mean, the voice still does that sort of, please keep doing it." I mean, I wasn't singing flat or anything. I just couldn't do everything I wanted to do. I don't know. He said there's still something worth it for us listening to you, so please don't stop.
Very beautiful. And so what's your secret? I mean, you look to me very healthy and you're singing everywhere and you're singing at the Metropolitan. So what's your secret? How do you keep that healthy?
Well, I have to thank my parents, I think, and probably the grandparents, and probably the great grandparents, and probably the great great great. Anyway, I'm given a body that is healthy. Singing music gives me, it's my fuel, it's my nourishment. And maybe that's something I've realized, that it sustains me. And oh, after a lot of concerts, I mean, I did had my senior that not my senior recital, my faculty recital in October. Then I went to England and did two more Pierrots plus some other unaccompanied stuff. And I come home, and yes, I have downs after having these wonderful performance experiences. So then I have to just rev up again. And luckily, I keep having opportunities. I think, I don't know. I think that, as I say, I think music is just my staple nourishment. If I don't have it, I mean, which someday I'm not going to have, or maybe I can translate it just into listening to music. Or, oh, what gives me great pleasure now, of course, is attending all the concerts that my students are doing. So that's thrilling to me to see them thriving and moving through their careers. I have a student who was in the very first class of this contemporary performance program, which was when I started teaching at Manhattan School, started in 2007. And one of the first graduates, Jeff Gavitt, has started an a cappella voice group called Ekmelis. They've come to Europe. They are just out of this world, able to sing microtonal pieces, commissioning lots of works. Have you heard them? You're
I've
nodding.
encountered Jeff and I also admire their work a lot. Yes, it's
Well,
very good.
I attend. They're about to do Stimmung of Stockhausen for Valentine's Day tomorrow night. I try to go to all of their concerts, and I just find them, it's just thrilling to, because there's this one of the sopranos was also a student of mine. So hey, that is very sustaining to feel like the from Jan to me to next generation, that's feels good.
Yeah, it's really great. And now when we look at the debut, the premiere at the Metropolitan Opera with Innocence by Kaija Saraiho, and are you very excited or nervous, or do you, I mean, you have performed this piece quite a lot and it's written for you, but does it make a difference now to sing it at the Met?
Well, it probably will. Does I mean, we always have a month of rehearsals, which is a little funny because there are only three of us who've done every single production since its premiere in Aix-en-Provence, which was in 2021. It was supposed to have been 2020. I'm personally totally grateful that it waited to 21, and then that messed up all of the scheduling. They've had the five places, all plotted within a 2-year period. Well, now it's going on till, it's been 5 years since it opened, and I actually just heard I'm going to do it in Paris also in 27. So I mean, it's gloriously long lived for me, rather than that little compact way it was supposed to be initially. But anyway, there are two of the students. It's about a school shooting, and I'm the teacher, and there are six students. There are nine languages. It's an incredible, incredible story, incredible piece. But there are just three of us, the French student, the German, sorry, the Spanish student, and me, who've done every single one. So that means, like, I think 36 of them performances. I'm just as excited about it now as I was at the beginning, which means that just speaks for the quality of the work. I get the chills. It's emotionally, well, I don't know if challenging is the right word. I mean, it's a very, there are a lot of emotions in the piece. I think if it were just a play or even an opera all in English, it would be almost unbearable. There's something about having the multi languages and all the different styles of singing. My Sprechstimme role, of course, is not something you would ordinarily hear, although there have been a few instances in the opera world already. And the folk singer, there's a Finnish folk singer, and who really sings in folk style, obviously mic'd. And I'm mic'd also. All the students are mic'd because they're primarily speaking roles. They're not sounds you would expect to hear from an operatic stage. And that variety is one of the beautiful complexities of the piece. Well, I was about to say, yeah, if it were all in English, I think the story would just be too painful. There's something about masking it a little bit with the mixed languages, so nobody will really understand all of them. I mean, we look at our surtitles, but still. And then, of course, the music completely embraces all of the feelings in the score, the tough stuff you feel. There's comfort somehow in how Kaya has orchestrated it. And the just her writing, her there's a beautiful aria that the bride has at the end in her native tongue of Romanian. That's oh, they're just there's so many special moments of the
Wow. Yeah, they're actually doing it a lot now in Germany too, and it's also very successful in a
is there
sense.
No, I didn't know that. Tell me.
There was one in Gelsenkirchen, and I think there's another one. Somehow there's no.
I didn't know that. That's wonderful. Okay.
Yeah.
Another opera that actually was written for me called Lucidity, which was just done in, I can't remember the town, but in Germany.
I don't know it right now, but yeah, we could look it up then.
I think so. I thought I was keeping track of that because I'm. Oh no, I went with friends to see the Dresden version of Innocence. I'm cuckoo. Yeah,
Yeah, they might have done it, yeah.
they did it. They did it. I was there. They took. It's through composed. There's not ever supposed to be a. They took two big breaks while they changed scenes. Kaya would have been very upset with that.
Interesting, interesting. And when you learn such music, or also when you teach your students, are there any strategies you can recommend how to learn a difficult contemporary music piece?
I developed a technique, yes, for it was unnecessary for Innocence because it's that Sprechstimme and it's a limited range. Although I have to tell you, originally in the score, for any time the teacher came, it said, in addition to whatever qualifying how you're supposed to do it, it said, sing in any octave. And I thought, oh, yummy. You mean I can do ninths and sevenths. I mean, I can do displaced octaves. So I wrote out my part with choices of, with a lot of, the basic part was just within an octave, like C to C, or maybe low A to C. So I wrote this out, and I showed it to Kaya January of 2020. We were sitting on a couch together. And I said, Kaya, is this what you had in mind? And I pass it to her, and this won't carry over the podcast, so I won't do it. But there was silence for what seemed like 5 minutes. You know, it was probably about 1 minute, if that. But as she was just looking at what I'd written, it was very uncomfortable. And I turned to Kaya and took the music. I said, oh, I guess not. And again, she didn't say anything. She just shook her head. No, the message was clear. That is not what I meant by, she did not mean for me to jump off. And that disappeared from the score, that directive. No, that's not what she wanted. I did, in working with her, we did get a few things that where I took it up, like, I love them like my own. It was written, I love them like my own. And instead of that, I do, I love them like my own, which is utterly different, much more expressive. So we got a few of those in there. And I think they are emotionally very important to the character to have a bit of that.
But this is the great thing when you do contemporary music and you can talk to the composer and make suggestions. And sometimes they are like, go for it. Or they are saying, no, this is not what I want. And for her, it's also not good that it's in the score, because otherwise maybe singers later on would do what you have tried to do. And now it's really clear, this is not what we want. And
appreciate this comment from her. One of the last rehearsals in X, I was told she wanted to talk to me, so I go over and greet her. And she said, Lucy, it's still too Kathy Barbarian. Okay, you're laughing. You get it. it sounded too new music-y to her. This was for the final aria where I get to do some odder things, techniques, you know, new music technique stuff. So she was very, very clear with me, you know, this is not, don't go that far, Lucy. Nope, rein it in. So that was a very interesting experience. Yeah.
That is very interesting, because I also know composers who, even though they whatever write what they write, but they still want it more natural. And this other thing, which is fun too, but can be also very exaggerated, and it's not always what they want, you know?
Okay, let me make this point. I really feel that composers, I want them to have an idea. I want them to hear what they want and put it down on the page. I'm totally anti, what do you like to do best, Lucy? You know, no, don't ask me. This is your piece. It's my job to realize whatever you put on the page. But catering, getting too much information from a singer, I don't like that. I want the composer to do the job. And I feel like too many young composers, well, first of all, they're doing it on the keyboards. How much do they really hear it before they put it down? And I'm totally with you that put it down and we try it. And if there's something that is uncomfortable, that doesn't work, then we say to the composer, and, you know, well, listen to the, I'm a little uncomfy. Listen, what do you think? And I've only one time had somebody say, no, but I want you to do that. And that was disastrous. I actually hurt myself because she kept me up in a high tessitura just way too long. And I shouldn't have allowed that. But yeah, composers I want them to, I want to be doing what they are imagining, and that's the challenge, to try to bring it. Don't ask me what I want to do. That would be boring. And besides, I don't know what I want to
Yeah, that's the thing, being an interpreter, that I always say it's like putting on different dresses, and I'm sometimes glad, even though I also like improvising like you, but I'm glad that I don't have to make the decisions that composers have to do. And then I can sing whatever, a more wild piece or a funny piece, or it's more meditative or whatever. And I like it that I can be so different every time. And also with certain pieces, I discover new techniques in my voice. I'm like, oh, I don't know if this is gonna work, but let's try.
One little word about improv. The reason I haven't done that, I love doing it, but I haven't done it publicly. I did these five with Anssi Kartunen, the cellist, which I absolutely adore. And that was actually Kaya's idea that we get together and do that. So that's kind of special. But the wonderful thing about improv is that you never make a mistake, because whatever sound you make, just do it again, and it's for real. You know, if you repeat it, then that's part of the structure of the piece. So you go some funny place. Oh, that was weird. Well, go there again, and that makes the piece. So it's so freeing to just, it's exploratory. And of course it's involved with listening to your whoever you're doing it with. So that's chamber music at its total best. I mean, creating something together with somebody on the spot is very exciting.
And what I also found very interesting about singing, and I'm curious how it is for you, because in contemporary music especially, you have to find crazy pitches. And I mean, I realized that we all do it, or there is not one system. I'm a person who does a lot. I don't have perfect pitch. I have very good pitch, but not perfect. But I have a very good body memory, and I do a lot with that. But I also have colleagues who have perfect pitch, or some like using the tuning fork a lot, or they think in intervals. I don't even think in intervals. I do it somehow differently, but it works. So how do you get your pitches?
Well, I guess I started to say this earlier. I developed a technique for learning when I was faced with Kurtak's sayings of Peter Bornemisza, the 55-minute huge opus of his, just voice and piano, which I was scheduled to do with Andras Schiff. And that piece, it has a humongous range. I mean, I think low E to a high G sharp above Queen of the Night. And it's full of sevenths and ninths, and it's so rangy, so disjunct. So I pulled everything. I do now what I call a pitch chart. So I just pull all of those pitches. Well, first I put them down the way the composer's done it, but then I will octave displace to bring it within the same range. And you never have to sing an interval bigger than a fifth if you transpose all of those to, if you displace them. And then, so I, and I do it phrase by phrase. So whatever's in the measure is in one breath. And then I put a tonality to it by playing a fifth. And never do the third, because we want both major and minor thirds to be consonant. So I just do the fifth in an octave, what I call a drone, and then I sing it with or against, however you want to, you know, the dissonance and consonants, and I have various games that make that clearer. But I do it with at least three different pitch drones. And by the time, and oh, it's so thrilling, because I mean, we only have 12 notes, but they are so different depending on their context. And this just points that out. You feel the melody, and you do it in the closed form, in these ways before you try to do any, because actually I want to hear ta da 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 da. I don't want to do da da da, sort of reaching da dee da 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 dee da. So it just feels like the second, even though it's a ninth. But after you've done your melody, the piece with these, each drone makes the piece totally different experience in your body, the tension and the release of the dissonance and the consonants. And then you look at the score and maybe, well, you have your favorite one, and so maybe it's G. So you look for G and D in prominent places in your accompaniment, in the context, something that will anchor you thinking that. But honestly, if you practice it, and that just reassures you. I mean, I did a Ferneyhough piece in the key of D, I think. It was full of microtones. Only the piano and harp could be consistent. I could do it because I had my tonality. And that makes it more expressive because for me, even in contemporary music, there still are dissonances and consonants for in my thinking and working this system. It gives an expressivity to it, and it helps the memory, and it makes the main thing it does is make you secure so that you can be expressive. If you're looking for pitches, we're going to hear that. You're smiling.
That is, it is so interesting what you're telling. I mean, the thing that I put pitches closer, I do that too, even though I have to, maybe because I have this strong body memory, I have to fairly early go on and do the jumps because for me, they feel so different in the body if I jump high or not. But the other thing you're mentioning with the drone, I also have found through contemporary music to medieval music. And I studied also medieval music and Hildegard, and they also do the drone thing. And I started doing that too with contemporary music when I'm like, I feel I'm totally lost. I need to find it to myself. And then I just did what you said. And this is so interesting because in medieval music, everything is related to the drone and it's so strong and so deep. And well, thank you for sharing. It's great.
Well, it saved my, I mean, it makes learning it just really fun and not something to be scared of. It's discovery and exciting in that way. I love looking at it, and I hope I get some new ones. I always go to the Yellow Barn Festival in Vermont, and the director there, Seth Knopf, finds amazing repertoire. I mean, I suggest things, but he finds stuff. So that's a rich time for me.
Awesome. And well, I think there's so much we could talk about.
Clearly,
And I'm also, you have to tell me the dates for Paris. Maybe I can come. I would like to see it, your piece.
it's November 27.
Okay, I will put it down. But yeah, I'm very grateful that we could meet and could talk, but I have one final question for you, which I always ask, and I would like to know what is the tip you would like to give young artists?
You've got to love everything you do. There's got to be heart in everything that you present. It's not show, it's heart and honesty with the music. If you don't like a piece of music, or if you don't like a composer, well, here's a funny tip. If you as a young singer, you want to probably say yes to everything because it's good experience, but and you treat it as if you did. I mean, it's being a good colleague is very, very important. But you can say no the next time that offer that, that, but make it a positive experience just for yourself, every time. You've got to find a way to love everything you do.
That's very profound. Thank you so much, Lucy. It was so great meeting you. And yeah, I hope I
Lovely
see
to
you
meet
one day.
you. Yeah, I think that'll happen. Lovely.
Yes.
Thank you so much. This has been fun.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.